Today, we're answering 14 NBA questions, Kawhi, NBA draft, Austin Reeves, Warriors, and a whole bunch else coming up next with Tom Haverstraw. Welcome back to today's episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show. Joining me on this Thursday is Yahoo Sports, Tom Haverstraw. What's up, Tom?
I'm great, Kev. How are you?
Today, let's talk about a bunch of NBA questions on my mind based on the week that was, starting with number one. Does Kawhi Leonard's resurgence make the Clippers a true contender? Because, Tom, in the month of March, Kawhi Leonard is averaging 25.1 points per game, 6.5 boards, 3.1 assists. He's making almost 40% of his threes, 43% of his mid-range jumpers, 82% of his shots in the restricted area. He's looking like his old self. He looks like his dominant Kawhi version against the Cavs, especially in the fourth quarter earlier in the week. What does this mean for the Clippers?
It's everything for the Clippers. I mean, the fact that he's playing period is a huge win for the Clippers. This was kind of the vision, is if you get James Harden, Kawhi Leonard, both playoff tested, Kawhi Leonard obviously more so championship tested, finals MVP twice over, that if you can get this guy healthy, who cares if he missed the first 6 months or first few months of the season? He looks great. And not only does he look like his old self, I actually think he's skinny Kawhi. He looks a lot thinner. It's less weight on his knees, and I feel like he's lighter on his feet, and yes, he's getting rid of the rust, but I love skinny Kawhi. If he's this efficient and this light on his joints, I think it probably not just bodes well for the Clippers' title chances. I have them as a three-star contender every week, and I've had them there for a while. I feel like skinny Kawhi plus prime James Harden, what he's looking like lately, and Zubats, who's just an amazing defender, Chris Dunn on the wing. Like, this team has serious upset potential in a good way come playoff time.
I mean, I had Marcus Morris on my pod earlier this week, and he thinks the Clippers are the team of the lower seeds best equipped to take down OKC as a one seed. And I think if you're talking about, and I push back at him, I'm like, dude, like, you can't expect Kawhi to stay healthy. You can't expect that. I said to him, you played 4 years of them, or he missed two of the years in the playoffs. He missed an entire season. The only year he played the full year was in the bubble when there was a long break before the playoffs. And that's all true, but that's a first round matchup if it's 1 versus 8. So Kawhi would only have to be healthy through the end of April for the Clippers to be at full optimal, you know, shape to have a chance to beat OKC. And I don't think they would, but you're right, Tom, like, missing as much time as Kawhi did to begin the season, in a way, maybe it's by design, right? Like, maybe it's like, okay, your season just started in March. Everything else prior to this was preseason for Kawhi Leonard, and you have Zubats completely outplaying Allen and Mobley in that game against the Cavs that they most recently played. Norm Powell, obviously, he's missed some time, but he was a borderline all-star. Harden was, and he's been even better since the all-star break. Zubats is awesome, as I just said. They have depth, they have versatility, and Kawhi is the star they needed. And so you look at the Clippers right now on BetMGM, they have the 11th best finals odds, plus 12,500. That feels too low to me. I'm not saying they should be favorites by any means, but can we get like closer to plus 6,000, plus 7,000? So I think those are really good odds right now for like a long shot, 11th best odds. I think they should be closer to some of those other teams ahead of them.
100%. And there is kind of a 2019 Toronto Raptors feel to them, where it's just like, if Kawhi can just have this like GOAT playoff run, all bets are off. And yeah, the way that he is, you know, like, I do think at a certain point, we have to seriously consider the idea of certain players have like 30 games in them, you know, like 30 elite games in them, not 100. Like, Jason Tatum's got 100. LeBron James has got 100. Luka Doncic last year, about 100 elite games from him. But some players at this stage of their career, it might be like moving into the closer position in baseball, where it's like, yo, he can't go nine innings anymore. He's got like 3 innings or max 2 innings that he can pitch at an elite level. Kind of like John Smoltz at the end of his career, where it was like, yo, if he comes in as a closer, like, what are you going to do with that guy? Same thing with Kawhi, where it's like, if you don't pencil him in for 90 games a year, which is the asking price for a championship winner, is can you play 90 games at an elite level? For now, with the way that stars are only playing 70% of their games at an NBA level, at a high level, I feel like Kawhi Leonard might be kind of the pioneer of, at this stage of your career, what if you just play 40 games, not 100, play 40 games and kind of make sure your body is healthy enough to go for the postseason run?
They beat the Cavaliers earlier in the week, and Cleveland, that was their second loss of 3 in a row. They won 16 in a row. Now they've lost 3 against the Magic, the Clippers, and then the Kings without Sabonis. The baseball comp for the Clippers is great, because for the Cavaliers, they've basically thrown a no-hitter the entire season. They've been dominant, and now it's the 7th inning. We're near the playoffs, near crunch time. There's a runner on base. three losses in a row. Or am I overreacting here, Tom, and you're not at all concerned about this recent skid for the Cavaliers?
I'm not concerned. The Kings loss is a bad one. That's a bad one. Without
not
Sabonis,
at all. Like 1 to 10, what's your concern level?
I would say a 3 out of 10.
A 3. Okay.
They're not playing all of their guys. If we put it another way, they're 16-3 in their last 19 games. I'm not concerned. I'm not even at a 5.
Well, I mean, you could put it that way. You could also say they're 56 of their last 69 games. Like they're 56-13.
they went on the road. They had a game at home against Orlando, which not a great loss, mm-hmm. going against an Orlando team that cannot score. And then they go on the road, West Coast trip. They begin it with 2 L's. It's going to be a lot more of a test the next to Phoenix, that's trying to fight their way into the play-in. They have the pole position there at the 10th seed, and they're hosting the Cleveland Cavaliers. And then the Cavs go at Utah, at Portland. Those 3 games, like if they drop all of that and start their road trip with 2 losses, okay. But if they lose their entire road trip, then we can start moving that from a 3 to a 6 or a 7.
I think that's fair. I mean, ultimately, Mitchell also has just been very cold from 3 basically this entire month. And one thing I will say on that note, Mitchell has not shot very well as of late, including in that loss against the Clippers. Including last night against the Kings. I wish Mobley didn't get frozen out sometimes. He had 31 points on 18 shots. Only 2 of those points came in the final 5 minutes after he checked back in to close the game. Barely got any chances to score. The only chance he did have was a defensive rebound. He grabbed himself, brought the ball up, missed a layup, grabbed his own miss, tipped it back in. Nothing was run for him when all game long he's shredding from the perimeter. He's attacking closeouts. He's shooting threes, everything. We saw the whole package from Mobley, and there's nothing funneled to him to close the game. And that's where sometimes I know Mitchell has it in him. You know he's a dominant scorer. But in those nights where he's not feeling it, turn on that facilitating, that playmaking side of you, which he has in him. And so that's the only thing I'd note with the Cavaliers. But I agree with you, Tom. I'm also not concerned.
Well, isn't that a good problem to have? Is that Evan Mobley is so good now that Donovan, yes, Mitchell should feel like, yep, he needs to delegate a little bit, yes, more, which is not, yep, a thing that we were talking about a year and, mm-hmm, a half ago. Is that, yo, you need to give the rock to Evan Mobley down the stretch. That was not a conversation, and Bingo. Now it is. And I think that's a sign that they have reached another level here.
I totally agree with you. Spot on. Exactly. The fact you're asking for more from Mobley when he's sharing the floor with those other guys says everything. Austin Reeves, last 5 games, averaging 29 points per game, 7.2 assists, 6.4 boards, shooting 40.4% from 3, 95.2% from the free throw line. That's the last 5 games. If you zoom out even further, last 17 games, ever since he scored 45 points last month, averaging 22.4 points, 5.6 assists, 5.1 boards on 30. 37% from three, 91% from the free throw line. Austin Reeves, Tom. Does Austin Reeves secretly have all-star potential?
Oh, yeah. It's not a secret anymore. All-star potential for sure. And what a story. Undrafted and coming into the league where LeBron like immediately points to him as like, yeah, you're that guy. You're the guy. And, you know, everyone gets on LeBron, LeGM, and that he's running the team. But like one of the things that I always commend him for is like being able to spot all-star potential in a guy that he has admitted, Austin Reeves has admitted, he did not believe in himself. Like he was like, yo, LeBron believes that I have this kind of high ceiling. And he's proven right. Like that guy is a connector in ways that, you know, when you look at Chris Middleton for the Milwaukee Bucks coming out of nowhere and
sorry,
being
I can't get Shabazz Napier out of my head. We all have our Mrs. LeBron. I have mine as well.
Yeah, Hasheem the Beat was drafted by the Thunder too. Like you're not going to bat 1,000, okay? You're not going to bat 1,000 in the NBA. And look, Shabazz Napier, that was a very much a rug pull. I feel like with the Miami Heat was Shabazz Napier draft that guy or whatever, and then LeBron leaves. But back to Austin Reeves. He is very much like Chris Middleton in my head, where it's like, if you can get that third star coming out of nowhere and elevating their game into all-star caliber, where he's a great playmaker, he plays so hard and defensively, yeah, he can get bullied sometimes, but he's also top five in charges in the NBA, which is kind of the blueprint of the Thunder and Tamani Kamara and other guys that have been elite defenders, Lou Dort, where they're just like pests. Like they are going to frustrate you to no end. And we saw that with Jaren Jackson Jr. on Wednesday night going against Tamani Kamara. He's gotten so many guys based on, you can say it's flopping, but it's clearly Austin Reeves gets under the skin of a lot of offensive guys. And he knows he's not going to be able to rim protect. So he's able to lay out his body and put it on the line to try to get those turnovers and get a foul on the opposing star. So for me, seeing a guy go undrafted to ascending to like, I'm toe-to-toe with Luka Doncic and LeBron James, it's an incredible turn and a great story in the NBA.
It's an amazing story. And I think for Austin Reeves, you mentioned the Chris Middleton aspect with him, clutch shot making, adding that ingredient for what he did for the Bucks for years. You could also say in some ways he's kind of the Lakers' Manu Ginobili because of that shiftiness, that downhill attacking, the ability to draw a ton of fouls. Like think about if those Spurs teams, if they didn't have Manu's clutch shot making, the playmaking next to Parker and Duncan, the ability to get into the teeth of the defense, draw fouls, finish tough against contact and length, help side coming over. Reeves brings that ingredient as the third guy behind Luka and LeBron. And what he's doing as of late with LeBron out, showing that, oh, hey, at this stage of my career, those flashes in the past, I can do this in a higher volume on a game-by-game basis. And so you don't have LeBron out there right now. You've got Luka, who looks all the way back the last few weeks. Luka is playing peak Luka as of late. All the iffy shot stuff as soon as he came back, that's gone. He's crushing in every way as of late. LeBron comes back. I wonder if LeBron now even leans more into his inner Draymond Green and defers even more to not only Luka, but also Austin Reeves to conserve his energy over the course of the season and also be that absolute dominant defender he looked like he was post-Luka trade.
I was going to mention it. Maybe the best thing that Austin Reeves making this glow up here is that it takes even more of a load off of LeBron. Luka Doncic was already going to be like, yo, I'm going to be the number one starting pitcher. You can take the number two slot and not everything's going to be on you every single night. And to continue that, now you've got Austin Reeves, who's like, I'm an ace too. I can get you 30 points. And here's the thing about Austin Reeves that maybe the most important number, and I wrote all those last five games averages. And the thing that jumps out to me, he's not foul grifting. He's got 4.2 free throw attempts per game, which is half of what you would say like Austin Reeves usually gets, or when he's like got all of his, when he's the guy out there, he is a guy that can get you double-digit free throw attempts. He's averaging 29 points a game with just 4 free throws a game, which is not like him. Like, you usually are like, dude, that guy got 15 free throws last night. How did that dude get 17 free throws? That's not what he's doing. He's creating, getting open shots, hitting tough shots. He's doing it a variety of ways that don't make you feel like it's unethical. Like he's doing something to bait the referees into these foul calls. He's doing it in much more ethical fashion. And to me, that's even more impressive that he has all these weapons at his disposal that doesn't include making, you know, crazy foul grifting plays that he is, you know, look, it's the best of them do it. He's also in that category.
I think that's a good point with him. It's below the season average for him, which is 5 from the free throw line. And this comes during his best stretch of the entire season as both a scorer and as a playmaker. And for the Lakers to continue to be in that competition for the 2 seed without LeBron, I mean, it's largely thanks to the ascension of Luka back to peak levels and Austin Reeves playing the way he is right now. They're only a game back from the Rockets for the 2 seed right now. One team that has moved back into the, not playoff, but play-in picture is the Phoenix Suns. They're 3 games back from the Kings for the 9 seed because they have officially moved into the 10 slot. They are tied with the Mavericks for 33-37 record, but they hold the tiebreaker over them. So Phoenix is the 10 seed. Tom, does Phoenix hold on to the 10 seed?
You hear those footsteps? Those Donovan clinging boom, 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 boom footsteps?
Get out of here. Get out of here. They're not happening. Or is it?
ESPN Basketball Power Index. Okay, their projection system has the Blazers, who are 2 games back in the loss column, but the Phoenix Suns tiebreaker is still up in the air because they've split the season series. BPI has them as a 16% chance, the Blazers, of getting to the 10 seed. 16%. That's not nothing, okay? And Phoenix has the toughest schedule going forward. So remember when we did that whole, like, when you're talking
schedule.
It's not even close. Like it's just like top tier juggernaut teams the rest of the way. Portland is happy that Phoenix passed Dallas because Dallas has the tiebreaker over Portland. And so if you're the Blazers, they've been playing like they want to win this 10th slot the entire time. I don't know that the Phoenix Suns do. Like, I kind of feel like they might feel like, dude, this Bradley Beal situation, the Bud, KD, fake drama, is it real drama? Everything's fine over here. We're not arguing. This is all healthy conflict. I kind of feel like just the desire alone, forget like Denny Avdia making this star turn. I think the desire alone for Chauncey Billups and this team to get that 10 seed with Donovan Klingon, with Denny Avdia, like the chances are about 1 in 5 right now. 16-17% odds at nabbing the number 10 seed. KOC, you can't laugh it off anymore.
I just don't want it to happen for Portland. I want them to compete, but I want them to get the lottery pick. I want the lottery pick. Is that wrong of me, Tom, to want the lottery pick? Is that wrong?
Well, then they got to make the playoffs. They can get the play in, and then we'll see what happens. But yeah,
get swept by OKC. I playoff experience, all nice and all. I'd also like a 5% chance at getting Cooper Flagg, or even higher, like a 23% chance of getting a top 4 pick. Sure, that'd be great. I'd love that too. And all the good reps down the stretch of competing, which they are. But so right now, because of the schedule for Phoenix, which is fair, they have the toughest schedule by far. The remaining teams have a 63% win percentage over the remainder of the season, which is just absolutely absurd to think about. Like, you're facing an average 52-win team over the remainder of the season. That's what the Phoenix Suns are up against. So right now, you'd pick against
I think Phoenix it's a coin that. Flip, honestly. Okay. I think it's a coin flip. I'm obviously biased because I'm on the Blazers broadcast, but the way that they're playing, and Denny Avdia, dude, the guy had 26-5-4 at halftime, okay? Like, he's putting up numbers lately that only, like, LeBron, Jason Tatum, Giannis, and Jokic are putting up. Just 16 rebounds and getting and ones. Again, he's leading the league in and ones since the All-Star break. That's MVP caliber play over the last few weeks from Denny Avdia, a guy that they gave up picks, Malcolm Brogdon, to go get. And he's 24 and playing at this level where it's like, yo, he destroyed the Memphis Grizzlies on Wednesday night, like destroyed them. And Anthony Simons comes in, is like, yo, I can get 30, no problem. Portland's good, dude. They're playing at a high level the last couple months.
Let's hold your horses on MVP level.
Dude, the numbers are that when you're averaging 25, 11, and 5, that's really good.
Sure.
That's incredible.
He's been tremendous. And still in the thick of that race is Dallas. They're the 11 seed right now, also two ahead of Portland at 12 and tied with Phoenix record-wise. Anthony Davis may actually be near a return. He was out golfing the other day in Dallas. He had a little stint with the G League team practicing. And Tim McMahon over at ESPN said this week that, you know, there's some people within the Mavericks that don't want him to come back because of the risk of injury, and obviously because they want their lottery pick too. But AD, he said, is not trying to hear that. Should Anthony Davis come back? And from Dallas's side of things, Tom, do you want AD to come back and try to get in? Or are you on the side of, no, let's all look ahead till next season?
This is too emotional for AD. It's too emotional. Like, he already rushed back one time with the Dallas Mavericks and got hurt and aggravated the injury. We don't need to do this a second time. It's hard for him. I'm guessing all of his being thrown into the worst trade in NBA history and having that attached to your name, that you were part of the package that people are saying worst trade in NBA history, worst trade in sports history, and he's got a chip on his shoulder. But look, man, like, he's getting up there in age, and this is the whole problem with that trade, is if street clothes Anthony Davis, as they call him, is so injured that even if they wanted to move off of Anthony Davis this summer, they can't because he had recurring adductor strains or groin strains, and you like Anthony Davis as a player, but he's so hurt that you can't bank on him, it's going to be bad for every party involved. So if I'm the Dallas Mavericks and Nico Harrison and Patrick Dumont certainly are not caring what I think or what you think or what anyone thinks, I would say make sure Anthony Davis is healthy for next year. And Kyrie Irving's not coming back for a while. And I think Anthony Davis, as much as he wants to play and shut up all the doubters, I think that's when you get into problems, when you let emotions direct your readiness to play.
If you're watching this video on YouTube, please give us a thumbs up. Give us a like. It really helps us out. And if you're listening on the audio feeds, please subscribe to The Kevin O'Connor Show. All right, Tom. Next question, number 6. The Warriors. They had their week that I've been looking forward to for a long time. It did not exactly go as I had hoped for with healthy teams. They lost to the Nuggets without Jokic and Murray, but then they beat the Bucks without Stephen Curry. I mean, Golden State continues to win games. They had a horrible loss, but then they had a really good win against a shaky Bucks team that we'll talk about in a few minutes. For the Warriors, you moved them into your tier one championship rankings over at Tom the Finder, your Substack, which people should go subscribe to. Are you keeping the Warriors in tier one for next week?
Didn't like that Denver loss. Didn't like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a bad one.
Didn't feel good.
It was a bad one.
It was a bad loss. But Aaron Gordon, but keeping
him in one? Are you keeping him in one?
At this point, the bounce back against the Bucks and what Draymond did in the most Draymond way possible. Was like, how does he continue to do this at this stage of his career? And, you know, defense is so hard to, like...
Tom, wasn't he supposed to decline? Wasn't Draymond, like, supposed to become the Albatross contract? Instead, he still looks like a defensive player of the year. He looks incredible.
Oh, my God. He shut down Giannis and created so many problems for that Milwaukee Bucks team that was coming in there trying to make a statement and continued to go 0-for against these great teams. And we'll talk about it in a sec, but the way that Draymond picked up the team and led them on both ends of the floor, just a fantastic performance from Draymond when he's locked in. And that may be the biggest upside of that Jimmy Butler trade was how locked in, not just on the floor, but off the floor, Draymond, the quotes that you're hearing from him, guaranteeing a championship, talking about how good they are and how he feels like they have as good of a chance as they've ever had at winning a championship. This feels like, to me, maybe the single biggest reason why you trade for Jimmy Butler. You get Draymond and Steph Curry believing in your championship viability. That's as good of a reason as anything.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Denver loss was horrible. And the Bucks loss was quite good, right? Because Draymond and Butler and basically the whole team, like the Warriors are deep. They have a lot of talent behind the star names that everybody talks about. I think they belong in that conversation for sure. Not, I still don't think they're a tier one contender, but I do think they're a tier two contender. Mm-hmm. And that's where I feel pretty good about keeping them. I don't foresee that I'm going to move them up to level one or tier one, but that Denver loss is going to stick in my mind as, I mean, and look, they have an easy schedule. It's just the reality of it. I wish they had more tests. I wish they had some more big marquee matchups. But one of the reasons why we're not getting to see that is because of something you posted over on X this week in regards to Wednesday night's games, in which there were 21 stars receiving DNPs. This is stars by definition of the NBA, as in an all-star or an all-NBA guy or at any time over the previous 3 years. And there were 21 stars playing. 21 not playing. 21 playing. Tom, guys are just missing a hell of a lot of time right now. So even if you have a marquee Warriors Nuggets on the schedule, you might actually not get that, which quite a bummer, man. Like that post you made me sad seeing that.
I did hashtag March sadness because of that very thing. It's just like we're at that point in the season where in April, we usually see this when teams are taking games off. They're shutting down their players. Yes, a bunch of these names are having serious, significant surgeries or recoveries that I'm not trying to make light of these injuries and saying they're not serious. Victor Wembanyama, Kyrie Irving come to mind here with the torn ACL and the deep vein thrombosis. But the number 21, I don't think really drives it home. I'm just going to read you these names because I think hearing it and seeing it is a reason why it struck such a chord with people. Anthony Davis, Kyrie Irving, Tyrese Halliburton, Andrew Wiggins, DeJounte Murray, Jalen Brunson, De'Aaron Fox, Victor Wembanyama, Joel Embiid, Paul George, Tyrese Maxey, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Jalen Williams, Chris Middleton, Larry Markkanen, Darius Garland, Zach LaVine, Domantas Sabonis, Nikola Jokic, LeBron James, Ja Morant, all out on Wednesday night. And that was just a Wednesday night. That wasn't every team wasn't playing. Not every team was playing on Wednesday night. And we had 21 stars of the 42 that were potentially able to play, in the sense that the 42 star players on rosters that were playing on Wednesday night and half of them were out. It speaks to a couple things. One, tanking. Two, the grind of the NBA season is way too long. Three, we have to figure out a way, and it's not the 65-game rule. We have to figure out a way for marquee matchups, especially ones that are on national TV, that teams, we know it, if this was the playoffs, we would have played them. Like, that is an excuse we get a lot, is that, hey, we're going to sit this guy because we're being smart out of abundance of caution. They're dealing with a bunch of stuff. But we got to get rid of back-to-backs. We got to get rid of any sort of excuse to play these guys. And you know why stars play 90-95% of the games in the playoffs? It's two reasons. The games matter more, and there's no back-to-backs, okay? We need to translate that for the regular season, because fans, you hear it when I'm out and about in town, they find out that I cover the NBA. They say, I'm out on the NBA. Just like, do the stars even care? Do they play anymore? And last night, Wednesday night, 50% availability of the star players. That's a problem.
I gotta admit, Tom, I was kind of distracted by the names on the list because I was just scrolling down and admiring your calligraphy. I mean, you are quite a talented writer. You have a very distinguished style. It's like all capital letters and just nice curves. And it's just your handwriting looks nice. I wish I had it. I have chicken scratch. I admired it. I really wish I could write like that. I would prefer to write instead of typing if I wrote like you, Tom. That's all.
Oh, it's that is like one of the big things that people wrote back to me is like, wait. Is that really your handwriting?
It looks like a font I should be able to pay for. Not just download for free, but like a pay for font. It was beautiful.
I'm going to give a shout out to Mrs. Judas, my AP stat. Oh, I didn't even need to say AP. That was sorry AP, for the brag there. My AP stats pants. Teacher from high school. Yeah.
I mean, people say humble brag.
Yeah. Mr. Your Statistician is, Face Man,
yes,
took some
exactly what I was going
classes.
To say.
Miss Judas, shout out to Miss Judas, who like gave me a senior science senior stats project, and I did it on ESPN Fantasy Baseball. They had these player rater. Player Jeff Bennett did these player rater scores to rank the best fantasy players in fantasy baseball. And when I was in high school, you could kind of like recreate that using Z scores in stats class. And I love that senior project. But the thing I took most out of that entire year with Miss Judas, she had amazing handwriting where it was like a font when she would write on the chalkboard and it was all caps. And I remember from that moment on that, like, I want handwriting like her. And I think it's stuck in my brain that as of now, I've got kids who are getting into school and stuff. And like, I can't believe it, but I trace it all back to my high school stats teacher. So shout out to teachers and Mrs. Judas. I know you're not watching, but someone get to Miss Judas and say, thank you. Your handwriting is phenomenal.
Nobody taught me well.
You didn't have a Miss Judas in your life.
I had some great teachers in elementary school. Miss Mello comes to mind first, but did not have somebody to teach me great handwriting. And if they did, I failed at it. Well, these injuries, one of the stars that's on that list is Nikola Jokic. He has a real injury. He has a real injury to his elbow right now. And ever since he injured that elbow a couple weeks back against Oklahoma City, he's shooting 6 of 30 from 3 and only 31 of 43 from the free throw line. And this is a guy who was well over 40% from 3 for the whole duration of the season. He gets sagged off of at times last year in the postseason and during the season, comes back an elite shooter. And that injury has definitely affected him, and it's affected the Nuggets if he comes back and he doesn't refine his improved shot. Tom, do you think the Nuggets are dead if Jokic doesn't refine his knockdown jumper?
I wouldn't say dead, because every team has their warts and weaknesses, that if he's still so good, even without a 45% three-point shot, that he can dominate a game without even shooting. Jokic is that good. But
they need shooting, Tom. They don't have a lot of shooting around Jokic.
And it's becoming a much bigger sore spot without his three-point shooting, like you said. To me, they're always going to be like in that three-star tier, the third tier of title contenders, because of that shooting, because of their defensive issues. And Jokic, like, I wrote about it this past week, that he is leading the NBA in baskets at the rim defended, meaning when he's nearby, he's given up the most baskets. And a lot of the issue is just they don't have great point of attack defenders. KCP is gone. Russell Westbrook at this stage is not a lockdown defender. And a lot of the thinking is Jokic, we don't want to wear him out. We don't want him to get in foul trouble, and we want him to get the ball out of the basket in ways that Mark Daigneault thinks is kind of cheating, and to get the ball out quickly and start a fast break the other way. They try to preserve Jokic by saying, like, don't try to be Dikembe Mutombo out there. Don't try to be Rudy Gobert. Just don't get in foul trouble. And part of this is like a strategy, but it also means that they're a bottom eight defense in the NBA. And Jokic, if he doesn't have a three-point shot and they're not able to make up some of that difference and mitigate the defensive issues with elite three-point shooting, they're not going to be able to contend at the highest levels. And so Jokic individually, he can still dominate without a three-point shot, but the Nuggets have a very low ceiling compared to the Warriors, compared to OKC, compared to the Lakers, if Jokic is not great from three and is not being an elite rim protector, because they just don't have anybody else if Aaron Gordon's not able to play every night.
I think he needs a three, considering the lack of other shooting on the team. Granted, as you said, he can still dominate without taking a single three in a game. For winning the NBA Finals, he needs to be shooting threes. Let's talk about the Bucks. They were the other game the Warriors had earlier this week. This is the Warriors' good win and a horrible Bucks loss, because they're facing Golden State without Stephen Curry, and their offense just looked absolutely horrific in the game. They couldn't get the dub. This season, Tom, on the surface, you look at the numbers. Giannis averaging 30.2 points, 6 assists, third in MVP, as you detailed on the Big Number, a podcast everybody should check out. Dame, 24.9, 7.1 assists on great efficiency this season, still one of the most efficient seasons of his career. And yet the Bucks are 16th in offensive rating. And it sputters at times and goes through these stretches where it just can't do anything at all, including against that Warriors in that game earlier in this week. Who's more to blame for this sputtering Bucks offense? Is it Doc Rivers? Is it Giannis Antetokounmpo? Or is it Damian Lillard? How would you stack those three up sharing the blame game here?
What about the front office? Will you throw him in there for that roster that they've built around Giannis and Dame? Sure. Honestly, Doc Rivers is probably number one on that list that you gave me. But at a certain point,
who's number two, Giannis or Dame?
Ooh, that's tough. I'll go with Giannis only because it feels like Giannis is in his prime, or at least can do a lot more for winning than he is willing to do. I think back,
he doesn't know how to set a screen, Dom. He doesn't set clean screens. Like, you're 7 feet tall and you're massive and you have a wide frame. Can we improve your screen?
He could be the
technique?
Best screener in the NBA.
Come on.
Like, he could be if you wanted to.
Come on. Like, what's going on? At this point, it's year two with Dame. You got to be better at screening.
So, Eric Spoelstra, after 2011, sat down with LeBron James and said, "We need you to be more like Karl Malone at the four, setting hard screens and rolling. It's not going to be enough to be watching from the top of the key and orchestrating the offense with your face pointed to the rim. Sometimes you're going to have your back to the basket and play like a four." And that unlocked everything for that team. Okay. It allowed Chris Bosh to move to the five, Shane Battier to guard wings. And that versatility that LeBron is 1 through 5 unlocked everything. And you know what's interesting about that conversation? LeBron hadn't won a championship yet. And he was listening because he hadn't won the big one yet. And I think Giannis ain't listening anymore. It seems like to me, LeBron James knew I have to listen to Pat Riley and Eric Spoelstra because they've walked that walk and won a championship. I haven't. So I'm going to listen to the kind of pearls of wisdom that they have and the ideas that they have because I'm trying to get what they already have. Giannis has already won a championship. Okay. He doesn't need to listen. He's already won MVPs. He's already won a finals MVP, one of the most incredible postseason runs in NBA history. Giannis already has that belt. So why does he need to listen to Damian Lillard and Doc Rivers at this point in his career? And the answer is, because if you want to be considered one of the top 10 greatest players of all time, this is what it's got to be. You got to do the little things. And that screen setting down the stretch against the Golden State Warriors was abysmal. It was embarrassing. Like, if you had kids watching, hey, here's how a big man, an MVP big man, sets a screen, you would turn the TV off because they're doing it so poorly. Didn't touch anybody. He's setting a screen that was forcing Damian Lillard to go out of bounds at one point. And Dame's like going the other way. Like, dude, what are you doing? And I can understand why Chris Haynes is reporting. I can understand the report from Chris Haynes saying Doc Rivers had to set up a meeting, called a meeting to get him on the same page because that was a disaster the other night.
I mean, at the same time, Doc needs to look in the mirror too here. I know sometimes you can have all these grand ideas and stars won't necessarily execute those ideas. Vogel wanted the Suns to play faster. Budenholzer wants the Suns to play faster. Sometimes your stars won't play the way you want to play. With that said, though, like Dame, he was getting pretty much triple the amount of reps off screens per game his final year in Portland as he does now with Milwaukee. There's like it feels like Dame never gets a three with movement. Like it just feels like he moves so much more off the ball using screens and handoffs in Portland than he ever has in Milwaukee. Like, he used more dribble handoffs per game with Nurkic than he does with Giannis. Like, that just can't be the case when you have these two guys together, especially if you're just using pick and roll when Giannis isn't the best screener. So I don't think they play fast enough, which is in part on Giannis. It's in part on Doc. He's always typically like to play slower in the half court. But this team is so good when they get stops and they're able to go out and run. They don't push the pace at all in the half court. So I think that's in part on Doc, but also in part on Giannis's preferred style of play where he likes to slow things down too.
Okay, Dame though. Dame is not perfect.
Nope,
Dame
he's not.
Deserves some criticism defensively down the stretch. He had some serious gaffes defensively.
Zero.
Where he let pods go twice in clutch do or die situations, lost them. And it wasn't, as far as I can tell, I'm no NBA coach, but I couldn't point to him being like, oh, there was a miscommunication where it wasn't actually his fault. These were two where he just turned his back on pods relocated, got a wide open three and hit him like he was Steph Curry. Two of them. And both of them were on just total brain farts from Damian Lillard. That can't happen. He's trying to win a championship. He might be worn down or might be at this stage of his career, can't be depended on to be an elite ace defensively. He's never been that, but he can't have those mental breakdowns in those clutch moments like he did.
We'll be right back after a quick break. All right, Tom, we got some news on Thursday morning. The Celtics have been sold officially. Wick Grosbeck and the Grosbeck family have sold the Celtics to William Chisholm, who is a Boston native, according to Adam Himmelsbach of the Boston Globe, who first reported the news. Himmelsbach said that Chisholm intends to buy a home in Boston. He watches every Celtics game. He's a hardcore fan. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of the team. So I'd say for Celtics fans, that's probably a good thing that it's going to a guy like the Grosbeck family that is true to Massachusetts, true to the Celtics, because that's what made Wick such an amazing owner over the last, you know, two decades. He's invested in this team. It has been number one on his list of financial reward. It's not like a lot of other owners where they have a bunch of businesses across the world. So that seems to be a good thing for Boston, but you know, $6.1 billion, that number came in a little bit lower than I think the Grosbecks were expecting. I think they were looking for over $7 billion, maybe $7.5 billion, but they don't own the arena. The Bruins own the arena. So, plus the ownership actually starts in 3 years. So the Celtics in that point will be in a dramatically different position than they are today. They're not getting the team today. It's not happening for a number of years from now. But what are your initial thoughts on the sale?
Why did it take so long? It was very quiet for a while, and then it accelerated really quickly. It seemed like the Las Vegas expansion and Seattle expansion, it needed kind of the Boston sale to kick things into gear. But even that, it feels like the dominoes have been falling. Like, first it was the media deal, that's why we haven't expanded, and now it's the Boston sale, that's why we haven't expanded, and we're still like waiting to hear about that next domino of expansion. And maybe it's a matter of like the owners needed to see what that expansion fee would look like once we saw the price of the Boston Celtics come in at $6.1 billion. How far do you think our bid went, Kevin, you and I, when we put our bid in for the Boston Celtics? Do you think they seriously considered it? Because like, I feel like we didn't put in enough money. Yeah. I don't have $3 billion. I don't know if you have $3 billion, but we made a good effort.
But about $6.1 billion off.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, for Wick and his family, they sell the team for the highest value of any American sports franchise ever, exceeding the Washington Commanders at $6.05 billion. So they can at least say that. But I do think they were expecting that total to be a little bit higher. But it is an interesting deal, though, because, you know, for Chisholm, you do have to wait to officially become the owner. And at that point, you know, it's going to be near the end of Tatum and Brown's deal. The team at that point could be incredibly expensive, which may have also played a factor here with luxury tax penalties, second apron penalties coming in for the Celtics if they want to keep this whole team together. So a lot of factors that are going to change the way this team is going to look, which is why I think it may have been a little bit closer to $6 billion rather than $7 billion for Boston. But ultimately, though, for Chisholm, just do what Wick did over the last 20 years, who has hired the right people, hiring Danny Ainge to run the front office, trusting them to make the right decisions. Wick also chose Brad Stevens to run the franchise after Danny Ainge left, and he's continued to empower his front offices to make the smart basketball decisions and just continuing to sign checks and letting them to make daring moves. To me, that's what new owners are going to have to do. You can't meddle in everything like Ishbia. You have to be willing to spend like Ishbia, but you can't meddle in everything. But you also can't be like Dumont and be hands off with the wrong guy running the team. So it's like a tough balance here for owners, and every owner typically seems to have new owner syndrome in one way or the other. Unfortunately, for Chisholm, it's probably going to have to be breaking up some things 3 years from now, considering all the luxury tax and second apron penalties.
Is the fact that he's not owning the team for another few years, does that absolve him from any sort of tampering charges if he just goes and becomes Cooper Flagg's best friend for the next few weeks? Because really, if you're going to be coming in like 3 years, I feel like you want to bring the main kid home, you know, like everything you should be investing in as a Boston Celtics owner to be is trying to lure Cooper Flagg to come back home. And that's going to be a tall order. But yeah, I would imagine that any owner in the NBA would love to have Cooper Flagg on their team, but especially so for the Celtics.
Let's move on to question number 10, the Pacers. They've been winning games. They had two crazy wins this week against the Mavericks and the Timberwolves. Pistons coming off of a win with a game-winning three-pointer by Cade Cunningham. Pistons and Pacers, Tom. Who's more likely to go on a deeper playoff run?
The Pacers, because we just saw it. I think Rick Carlisle has done that before, where he's led teams all the way to a championship. So I have more experience, belief in that Indiana Pacers team. But you saw Cade Cunningham after that game talk about how much that three-pointer, and it was glass. He didn't call bank. I don't think he called bank. It is weird to have a three-pointer go in. It got me thinking, KOC. Do you think banked threes should be worth three? Or do you think there's a way where we can
Why not? We don't have to overcomplicate things. It's a three. Your feet are behind the line. It's a three.
But you're never intentionally banking in a three-pointer. Like, who does that?
I don't know. You want to add a four-point line. You want to make bank threes worth what? One? Two?
I think two. I even think that a game-winning...
It doesn't have to be this color. What if you bank in a four-pointer? Should that be three?
That should be seven, actually. That would be cool. A banked in four-pointer. Now we're talking. Kev, what if in 10 years, game-winning shots, the backboard evaporated. It just went away. We have a digital backboard or something that you could pull away, like Star Trek style, so that no banked in threes that could be a game winner. I don't know. Unless you call bank, unless we have an audible, I call glass or bank when you're shooting the shot. I don't know. It feels weird. Anyway, Kate, besides the cockamamie ideas that we have, or I have, I should say, I don't want to throw you into this disappearing backboard theory. The Pistons feel like they've got some serious moxie now. I feel like they've got this no one believes in us attitude, to borrow Bill Simmons ism, where it's they're continuing to prove people wrong. Bam Adebayo blanketed Cade Cunningham on that possession, and still it was they continue to deliver in these big moments that make me believe more and more. I put them on the title tiers by default when the Kyrie injury happened and I had to take the Dallas Mavericks off. I put them in there as a one-star title tier contender just by default. And now I'm okay, do they have upset potential? I think they still need a little bit more from everybody outside of Cade Cunningham. Malik Beasley, can you trust him in the playoffs? And Tobias Harris in the playoffs? But they're great, at least in the regular season. And the Indiana Pacers side, if it's 4-5 Indiana versus Milwaukee, and Indiana's got the home court advantage, do we see that Indiana beats Milwaukee a second time in a row in the playoffs? With Giannis time?
Yeah. If that were to happen, going to be very interesting what would happen in Milwaukee this summer. Very interesting to see what would happen there. I do think Indiana's the fair choice, considering they've been to an East Finals before. But boy, that Pistons team is so freaking fun. And regardless of how far they go, their progress has been very, very impressive. Another team taking steps forward this season has been the Houston Rockets. They're currently the 2 seed in the Western Conference, 8 wins in a row. They've won 5 of those games, without Amen Thompson, who's currently sidelined by an ankle injury. Fred VanVleet came back during the stretch, and they've been starting Şengün, Tari Eason, Dylan Brooks, Jalen Green, and Fred VanVleet. Got a mailbag question from Robert from Austin, who said, does it make sense for Amen Thompson to come off the bench when he returns from injury? I'd say yes, Tom. They get the adult in the room and VanVleet right now. And Amen, I don't think it matters if he starts or comes off the bench, but right now that starting unit is working. And I'd like Amen to be just that energizer bunny that comes off the bench and just changes the whole tempo of everything on both ends of the floor. So I'd lean yes, even though I'm not the biggest VanVleet fan. It seems to be working right now with him starting.
Yeah, he's a stabilizer offensively.
Yes.
He's the veteran. He's won a championship with the Toronto Raptors. I would have Amen Thompson just watch Andre Iguodala tape when he was with the Warriors and just be like, that's the guy. That's the guy. Lockdown defender, connector offensively, just high energy plays, cerebral plays. And I feel like we're headed for a big glow up on the Thompson brothers, where it's like in the playoffs, when most of America is now watching, there, I think the Asar Thompson, Amen Thompson brothers, where the Pistons and the Rockets are going to be in primetime, I feel like there's going to be a couple moments where they're going to be leading ESPN. Like, they're going to be the talk of Twitter. They're going to be going nuts about these guys and how good they are and how they're kind of just, what did I call Amen Thompson with? We have some great nicknames on that show on The Big Number. He's like an NBA flubber. Like, he's Kawhi flubber, where he's just like, he has these Kawhi moments where he's just robotic, but he's made a flubber. Like, he just bounces around everywhere, and he's an incredibly talented player. And these guys they're second year guys. They're just figuring out how good they are. And I can't wait for the Thompson brothers to have their glow up.
You saw the Memphis Grizzlies against your Portland Trailblazers on Wednesday night. Grizzlies lost that 115-99 in a rematch from last year's national championship game between Purdue and UConn. Kling Kong, Donovan Clingan, and Zach Edey. Clingan completely outplayed him. I mean, Memphis is sputtering. They've won only 8 of their last 17 games. They have really struggled defensively. What do you think is wrong with Memphis after you watched last night's game, Tom?
I just don't think they have the continuity. You know, Ja Morant's been in and out of the lineup all season. They have a certain brand of basketball that requires a lot of attention and a lot of attention to detail, where they're constantly moving off the ball. They have this weird, like, cyclone offense where they don't really do a lot of ball screens. And with how much depth they have, you still need, like, three guys that can be kind of the hub of that offense. Jaren Jackson Jr., Ja Morant, and Desmond Bane. How many times this season have they been on the floor together? And at certain points, you need that continuity. And, you know, Ja Morant, they want him to be healthy for the postseason. He's been banged up this season, and he's had flashes where he's been that kind of taking the throne, taking the baton to be the next American great basketball player. But has he been available enough for them to reach that height? For me, Zach Edey, in that he couldn't stay on the floor. And they tried to go with Jay Huff to space the floor and to try to pull out Donovan Clingan. But DC, Kling Kong, he moves his feet really well. He blocked a three-pointer at one point. They're trying to space him out. But he's a versatile big. Like, he's a guy who can move his feet, and he's only going to get stronger. I think he's got conditioning, room for improvement. And look, the Memphis Grizzlies blew out the Blazers by like 43 points earlier this year. Looked like a completely different team on Wednesday night.
So March Madness begins on Thursday as we are currently recording. March Madness has begun. It's 12:30 Eastern as we record right now. What's your national championship pick, Tom?
Duke. Everyone in my circle isn't picking Duke.
Picking Duke too. I get Duke as well. Over Michigan State, for what it's worth.
Is everyone getting too cute? I just feel like Duke is, I mean, if Cooper Flagg is healthy, of course.
Yes.
But I feel like this is Duke's year.
Yeah, I think so too. They're dominant on both ends of the floor. Cooper, like, after the injury happened, I was like, uh-oh, it's over. But then in the second half, he's back on the bench. He doesn't have a walking boot. He's walking under his own power. I'm like, okay, he's probably going to be okay. Maybe he misses next weekend. The fact he's playing their opening game on Friday against the 16 seed, he can play 10, 15 minutes and that's probably all they need. They might not even need Cooper to win that game. We'll see if I'm completely jinxing them at this point right now, Jabari Parker style, their early round loss years ago. But Cooper is no Jabari Parker, and I don't think he would let that happen. And this team as well is a lot more talented behind them. I think people are getting too cute here. Duke is an absolute dominant force, elite defensively, elite offensively. And we saw this past weekend, Cooper goes out. Con Knipple steps up, runs 14 pick and rolls in the game, a season high for him. He's throwing lobs to Kaman Malawach, their other lottery center. Malawach on Sunday is switching on the perimeter and sliding his feet. Like, they have other guys on Duke. Evans, Proctor, like, they have a lot of talent on that team, aside from Cooper.
I told you. Like, I saw them at Cameron Indoor earlier this year, and I was like, Malawach is the real deal.
He's awesome.
You put him in an NBA offense, he's going to be outstanding. I love this roster, and it pains me to say it as a Wake Forest Demon Deacon, but this Duke team is loaded. They're stacked. Mm-hmm. Neil Payne over on his Substack wrote a great piece about how this is one of the most stacked teams, performance-wise, efficiency-wise, competition-wise, that we've seen in years. They're like an all-time talent, and I don't feel like people are recognizing it. And they could go out in the second round, and we look very stupid right now, KOC. That's why March Madness is so much fun. But I feel like Duke is like the heavy favorite for me.
Yeah, me too. I already answered this final question here. It's a mailbag question from Thomas. He's a Bulls fan. He asked, who should I be excited about for my Bulls to target? We'll expand this to all teams that are kind of in the middle of the lottery right now. We answered it with some of those Duke guys already, but one name I want people to know, and this guy's playing on Friday for Maryland, it's Derek Queen. Derek Queen, 6'10", 6'11". He looks like a Boogie Cousins, Nas Reed type, with the way he just has big man size, but a guard-like handle with how shifty he is and how low he gets to the ground and his finishing and the playmaking flashes. I think Derek Queen, if Maryland makes a run, is A, going to become a national star because of just how fun his game is, but B, he probably could move into the top five, top six-ish range on a lot of people's draft boards. I'm not quite there yet with him on my personal board. I have him around 10, which is currently where the Bulls' odds are, but Derek Queen is one of those guys that I think a lot of people are going to be watching saying, ooh, I hope my team drafts this guy.
How do you view the tournament as a draft guru? Like, has there been a prospect that led you astray because you were like, wow, what a run in the tournament? Big games, national audience watching you, came up big, and then felt like you went a little overboard with the love?
You know, I don't think you can overvalue it. But at the same time, like, this doesn't really answer your question, but it's kind of the inverse answer. It's like, well, maybe it did mean something that Parker wasn't able to lead Duke out of the first round, you know? Like maybe it does mean something there. And that's the question I'm asking right now with Dylan Harper and Ace Bailey. It's like, well, how'd those two not lead Rutgers even to a low seat? Like, how'd they not lead the team to be that good enough? You know,
what is the answer there? That, like, for me, who's not a college hoops expert or a draft expert, does that say more about Rutgers and the program or the two guys?
I honestly think like you can find one example to favor one argument and then another example for the other argument. And it's all just noise. I really think so much of it is just noise. And ultimately, though, I do think the overall value in college basketball is, whether it's March or whether it's January, a conference game, or whether it's early March, conference tournament, championship, whatever it is, these guys playing in high-pressure situations with crazy crowds and loud noise and national TV and all that, that does matter. It matters a hell of a lot more than a guy playing in an empty gym, which was tough about some of the G League Ignite guys before that shut down. Like, a lot of the NBA people I talked to over the years are like, I don't know how to gauge some of these empty gym guys. But college basketball, the pressure matters. Seeing somebody perform in clutch moments, I do think that matters. I do weigh that. If a guy over and over does come through in clutch late game moments, whether it's March or whether it's December and January, to me that matters. coming through in the clutch moments. But again, it's a small sample. You can't weigh it too heavily because, you know, the next 20 chances they might miss those shots or cough up the ball and turn it over. But it does matter.
In some ways, them taking the shot is more important than actually whether it goes in. It's the process rather than the result. Is like if his teammates look to him as the leader, as the go-to guy, the alpha on the team, it kind of says something about you as a prospect and your character.
Yes, sometimes. And then you look at Trey Johnson on Wednesday night against Xavier, and he takes a stupid three-pointer with 16 seconds on the shot clock, heavily contested. He holds his pose afterwards. And he misses the shot. He fails to get back on defense. And then once he does get back on defense, he fouls a guy from behind for an and-one layup. Like, oh, my God, what are you doing? Yes, I know you're clutch. Yes, I know you're fearless. Yes, I know you're unafraid to take those shots in those moments. But make the smart play. Don't follow up the dumb play with another dumb play. Like, come on. So the process matters sometimes. Yeah. Oh, boy. I want to love Trey Johnson, Tom. That top, people will not be watching Trey Johnson from Texas this month because they lost to Xavier. But yeah.
Well, I feel like the ACC, I'm betting on the ACC. I got Clemson going far. I got Louisville going far. This happens every year where ACC gets like four teams. The SEC gets 775. And yet the ACC can't get more than like a couple teams in when they do so well in the tournament, and they're the crucible of the ACC and all the talent is that is there. I just feel like the tournament is where the cream rises to the crop. And so I'm betting on the ACC teams.
Last name, Neat Clifford from Colorado State, 2 PM Friday Eastern time. Watch Neat Clifford, Colorado State against Memphis. That dude is a lottery pick in my book. Tom, appreciate you joining me today, man. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, appreciate it. And March Madness, I think there's some Yahoo Sports folks who have their brackets in, and I want everyone to beat me. I would rather finish so poorly than I finish in last than finish in like the top 10. I want to see how everybody does. By the time this gets out, I don't even know if you can do a bracket, but hey, appreciate all those who
close.
Signed
us. Too late. Millions have already done it, though. Tom, appreciate you joining me on today's episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. Thank you to Emmy and Mike for producing it. Please give us a like on YouTube, a thumbs up, subscribe over on the audio feeds. Hope you have a great rest of your day.